America's economic and political inequality, has led workaday Americans to exclaim, "The system is broken. Let's fix it." But there's another version of this protest that I'm hearing more frequently these days. "The system is fixed. Let's break it." That certainly applies to such rigged systems as money in politics and voter suppression, but it's also relevant to seemingly mundane matters that restrain our personal freedoms. One of the insidious fixes we need to break is the claim by brand-name corporations that we consumers must be banned by law from repairing the products they sell to us. The weak battery in your cell phone, the fuel sensor in a farmer's tractor, some gizmo in the toaster you bought, a fuse in your business's truck? You could fix all of these yourself or, with a little hassle, take the problem to a local repair shop. But no, such manufacturing powerhouses as Apple, John Deere, and Panasonic assert that only their corporate technicians are authorized to open the product, which you own, to make it work again. So you are expected to deliver it to their distant facility, wait however many days or weeks they tell you, and pay an inflated price. They've literally fixed the fix for consumer products. They impose their control by making the products as needlessly complicated as possible, then claiming that the complexity is their patented proprietary product. Thus, they say, they don't have to provide repair manuals or sell repair tools to consumers or independent shops. Gotcha. To give their closed profiteering system the force of law, the giants have deployed armies of lobbyists and lawyers to legislatures and courts, arguing that self-repair people really are scoundrels trying to circumvent safety and environmental rules. This is Jim Hightower saying, for action, go to U.S. Public Interest Research Group, usperg.org. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said on Friday, I see the bipartisan infrastructure bill as a pretty big deal. This is the Steele and Joe Biden line, a big blanking deal. I'll tell you, I was one of the people who wasn't sure anything would get done. I'm happy to see that this is done. Now the other part of it has to happen. There has to be something in the Build Back Better plan to help us undo some of the damage that we were just talking about with Jeff Hauser. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how big is this bipartisan infrastructure bill? And if the chances of actually getting something else done, I've asked John Paul Smith to come talk with us. John is the executive assistant to the AFL-CIO's Secretary Treasurer Fred Redmond. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Good to see you again.
So it's been years since you've been on the program. I mean, I remember you as Superman in Metropolis, Illinois, fighting the was it Honeywell at the time?
Honeywell. And first off, thanks for having me back. And want to take just a moment just to say thank you for that time when we were fighting that company as a small local in Illinois. We didn't get a whole lot of people to listen to us, and you always welcomed us on the show. So I just want to tell you thank you for that.
No, it's part of the things that we do here. I want to talk about working people's issues. I want a better, more prosperous working class for all of us. And this is how we get this stuff out. Let's talk about the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Surprised it passed on Friday?
I wouldn't say it's surprised. It passed on Friday. Surprised it took long enough to pass. You know that it took to get to Friday, but that's just one step in the next part of the plan here.
Now, as I understand, look, it's apprenticeship week in the building trades. This is a perfect time to have this plan roll out, because this ultimately it means jobs. It means good union jobs.
It does, and it's not just the building trades. Although the building trades will see an influx of jobs from the money being sent from this bill. But the bill also reworks how the government buys goods with changes to the Buy America policy. It establishes, the Made in America office that looks at government-wide spending and how they accrue their products. And some of that will, I heard in the last segment you talking about supply chain issues. As far as government procurement, if they're supplying domestic products built right here in America by union workers, then that does alleviate some of those supply chain issues.
Yeah, and what we need is we need to rebuild manufacturing. ultimately. And as I started off at the beginning, part of the problem of where we are politically is the fact that those small town factories have been eviscerated, that, you know, across this country, you've got communities that are just, you know, living in poverty because that anchor industry was policy wise, you know, shipped overseas. It didn't just happen. It wasn't an invisible hand. It wasn't, you know, just a company deciding. No, it was policy that made that happen. And for me, we can undo some of that horrible.
I think that's right. And it's I think it was a combination of policy, right? A combination of trickle-down economics along with bad trade deals that led to that. You know, my hometown, very small, lost three plants, the anchors of that community. And when the jobs left, the people left. And it's not just small towns. It's, you know, large towns, Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh. And like you said, small towns across the country that have suffered from bad policy decisions.
Yeah, we had a guest on a couple of weeks ago who was telling us that a small town in Ohio, Manchester, Ohio, where they had a factory. It was your quintessential, you know, one company town where everyone depended on that factory for the economic activity, and it's gone. The storefronts are now all boarded up. The windows are broken. It's got, you know, bad epidemic problems. It's got high poverty. It's got all that stuff. And when the people of that community went to their representative and said, "Hey, can you help us?" He said, "Yeah, move." And you go, that's not quite the policy chops that I'm looking for from a representative. Now, oddly enough, and, you know, predictably enough, he was a Republican representative. But, you know, it was one of these moments where you go, this is where we need strong policy, smart investment to rebuild those communities and those lives.
Yeah, we have to look at both manufacturing we need today and the manufacturing of tomorrow. You look at, like I was talking about my hometown, we lost a plant that made kitty litter, a plant that made foam, and a plant that made furniture. And you look and think about where those items are being made today and where the jobs were lost at here.
Yeah. Now I'm looking at the passage of this bipartisan infrastructure bill, and, you know, a lot of people are, you know, saying, well, we should have gotten more. I, again, am literally surprised anything got done, given the fact that this is probably the most narrow margin of majority that we've seen in decades, when you can only lose, you know, a handful of seats in the House and no seats in the Senate. This is important. This is an important victory to celebrate.
It's absolutely an important victory to celebrate. We should be taking a victory lap, but at the same time, educating folks all over the country on what their community is going to get from this bill. And you look at, you know, these type of investments, I wouldn't have been surprised if it happened when the Democrats had the supermajority, you know, after the 2008 election. But I'm very optimistic about being able to get it done now.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
The super thin majorities.
No, this is the thing, and I keep coming back to, why didn't we get it then? I mean, this is something, this is the kind of bill that I was calling for back then. In fact, I wanted bigger because, to be honest, you know, $1.2 trillion is a lot of money. It is. But the American Society of Civil Engineers says we need about $4.6 trillion. We need something about four times as large as this just to get up to where we need to be. Again, we need this. It's a big historic investment, but it's not quite enough.
Yeah, and I want to make 2 points here. One is, I agree. I look back and say, why didn't we get more things done then? But I'm not going to live in yesteryear like the administration we just got out of and keep looking backwards and try to look forward. But we look at this like a down payment for what we need to do going forward. But look, in the labor movement of anywhere else, we know that we have to get to a consensus somewhere. And we don't have consensus on $4 trillion, but we did get consensus on $1.2. Looks like we're going to get consensus on about $1.75. And those together, even though we kind of talk about these numbers like they're something small, this is a gigantic investment into our people that we haven't had since probably the, you know, 50s, the 40s.
No, this is, as I said at the beginning, a BFD. This is a big deal. Now, what I find interesting is you got people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who now have somehow come around to this idea that investing in infrastructure is somehow communism. And I wonder, you know, what you know, if we could, you know, go back and ask Eisenhower when he built the highway system, if he thought that he was doing something for the communists.
Yeah, the party of Lincoln is long behind us, and even the party of Reagan, although I didn't agree with a lot of those policies and don't now, is even further behind us. And I find it hard to and just kind of refuse to entertain the arguments of that faction. I have to realize they exist. We all have to realize they exist. They're real. That faction of the Republican Party.
That's the right idea.
We can't engage in debate with people who are not going to come to the table with realistic positions.
Yeah, you can't argue with crazy people. No, I'm there with you. I am right there with you. So let's talk about the moment, because labor is in an uptick moment. I've been saying for a while, labor is the new black. Evidently, you know, everything is you know, heading in a good direction. We're seeing more worker militancy. We're seeing some strikes being won. What's the sense where you're at there at the AFL-CIO?
Well, you know, we have a new leadership team at the AFL-CIO. President Shuler, first president, that's a woman of the AFL-CIO. Secretary Treasurer Redmond, first African-American Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. And Executive Vice President Tafari Gabray, a black immigrant, Executive Vice President of AFL-CIO. It's the most diverse leadership team in the history of the Federation. But look, we just got out of Striketober. Happy now to be in Strikesgiving. There's a supposed labor shortage in this country, but I don't think it's a labor shortage. I think people have realized through the pandemic, they're tired of working, and I almost swore on your radio show here, they're tired of working in crappy jobs for low pay and no benefits, and they're standing up and doing something about it.
No, and this has been coming for a while in my view. And again, this is one of those moments, JP, where you go back to, you know, 2009, where I was hoping that in that moment, you know, workers would go, you know what, we've had enough. We demand better, you know, better wages, hours, conditions, all of that stuff. It only took us another more than a decade to get here, but we're here. So are you optimistic that this will continue, or do you fear that this could be a short-lived thing to get us through the holiday?
Look, no, it can continue if we grasp this moment. And you're right, it is a moment, and we have to take advantage of that. We have the most pro-union president since FDR, in my opinion, and policies that can help us. And you also have an unemployment rate at, what, 4.6%, something like that this week. So labor truly does have the power if the people will get together while we're watching, you know, corporations and private citizens shoot rockets into space, and people are trying to figure out how to pay the rent.
Now, you bring up the guy who's shooting rockets into space, or one of them anyway. Elon Musk said on Twitter that he's considering selling 10% of his stock in Tesla so that he would pay some taxes. The fact that that was a tweet, the fact that that is something that was even thought of and said, is the reason that we need a wealth tax and we need something to tax the hell out of these people who have just unimaginable amounts of wealth and power that you know, unfortunately, a democracy cannot have.
Yeah, I read something, I think it was last week, where through the pandemic, through over the last year, we gained an extra billionaire every 17 hours. And you know, in our country, the tax policy, all the people paying taxes are you and me, people who are going and working every day, you know, middle class and low income families, and the people who make the most money pay zero, reap the benefits of our labor. We have to change that.
No, absolutely. And this is one of those things where I'm looking at the Build Back Better plan, and there's an opportunity. You know, I get people from the patriotic millionaires to come on and say, look, tax me. I'm wealthy. We need things. And this is where, as a tax and spend liberal, and I wear that badge proudly, I say, you know, we need things. We need roads. We need bridges. We need chompers for granny. We need lots of stuff. And you got to pay for it. You can't just keep whipping out the credit card and borrowing money, as we've seen through many Republican administrations. We got to raise the revenue to fix things up. And now is that time.
No, that's absolutely right. And I look at, you know, I call myself sometimes a student of history. I look at how our country moved out of the Great Depression. And we moved out of the Great Depression with the tax rate on the most wealthy Americans at 90%. And guess what happens when you tax rich people? They're still rich. And so we're not going to have less rich people by changing some tax policies, but we could have a system that benefits the whole of our people a little better.
No, I mean, this is where, you know, again, you think back to what built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And look, we can, and there were problems back during the 30s and 40s and 50s, unquestioningly, that need to be addressed, and we will do better the next time. But it comes down to having a good tax code that rewards work, and punishes, you know, obscene wealth, and workers having the ability to collectively bargain for those better wages, hours, and conditions, actually sharing in the wealth that their labor creates. This is not a difficult policy. Having education attainable, having healthcare attainable, having all of those things in places that, you know what, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead, you have a society willing to go to work.
Yeah, and you know, I don't even think we have to go as far as punishing wealth. I think people who are the wealthiest in our country can absolutely pay their fair share like the rest of us do. And there's no reason why we should be the wealthiest country in the world and not have the best healthcare that we pay the most for, not have the best infrastructure that is crumbling around us. We have the ability to fix these things around us, not have paid leave, not have all of the things that we can see the rest of the world have who aren't as wealthy as us. It just, we have to do better and be better.
Without question. Now I'm looking at, you know, the coming weeks here. Obviously the House is out on session. I have said that Democratic representatives need to right now, you know, wake up, you know, tomorrow, the day after, they need to get to a picket line. They need to take on a striking worker for a day. They need to spend the day with them listening, not talking, you know, basically getting a master's course in working class economics. And I say this to my liberal friends as well. Find a picket line, find a group of workers, and hear what they're going through. Don't talk, don't say anything, just listen. I think we'd be a much better off society if we could get to that point.
You know, I can't argue with that. There's picket lines all over the country. I think if you go to AFL-CIO.org, you can find a strike map. Literally picket lines all across the country. And I would encourage anyone who has a break to go visit the picket line. And if nothing else, just hear from the workers out there and why they're standing up.
Yeah, now you're someone who, like me, has been on strike in the past. You know what it's like. In fact, I know a number of times, not only were you on strike, you were locked out. This is a hard thing on families. This is a hard decision for workers to do. This is the last arrow in the quiver. And I know I've gotten responses from people go, well, you know, just greedy and lazy. I'm going, no one does this lightly, JP. This is something that this took a lot of thought, a lot of soul searching, and a lot of struggle.
Yeah, no one chooses to not get their next paycheck. You know, out of thin air. There's thought, there's deliberations, and that's literally, as you know, Rick, it's the last option in bargaining for fair wages. And so to choose to withhold your labor, knowing you're not going to get paid, knowing the bills are going to come in, you know, it takes a lot of motivation to do that. And unfortunately, that motivation comes from companies and employers not treating their employees fairly.
Yeah. Now, the big one that's coming up here very soon, there's the potential of a strike at Kaiser Permanente out on the West Coast. Potentially, from what I understand, some, you know, 35 to possibly 50,000 employees being on strike. And it's one of these situations where I looked and saw what Kaiser had offered, which was a 1% raise for each of 3 years and then a 25% cut to new hires. I looked at that and I'm going, it seems to me like Kaiser wants a strike because no sane, rational person could have ever, ever accepted that agreement. And now they've bumped it up a little bit, but not all that much better. It seems to me like if nothing changes substantially, we could see, you know, tens of thousands of people on the West Coast out on strike.
So for a company who had $2 billion with a B profit last year, raked in $2 billion in the, you know, one quarter of this year, sits on a reserve fund of $44 billion, whether it be dollars. You think they picked the wrong fight at the wrong time to go, you know, against healthcare workers, the same folks they called heroes throughout the last year. But that's exactly what they've done with their proposal, with the 1% wage and the two-tier system. And it goes further than that because they have a racial wage difference right there in Southern California also.
So there's a lot to straighten out here. So any feel on how you think this is going to go? From the people I've heard from, it's almost certain. But then I hear folks on the other side saying, well, you know, they're still negotiating. Do you get any sense of where this could head?
I know they are still negotiating. You know, I've checked in with folks on the ground there, but we're at Monday, right? And they gave notice on Friday. So that puts it about 7 days for Kaiser to get their act together, or they're going to have a lot of explaining to do to their patients and their management staff.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But John Paul, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Really great seeing you again. Please don't stay away this long next time. Come back and talk to us again.
No, appreciate it, Rick. Happy to come back anytime.
Good stuff. John Paul Smith, he is the executive assistant to Fred Redmond, the secretary treasurer of the AFL-CIO. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day members of the industrial workers of the world began a free speech fight in Spokane, Washington. Wobblies often intersected seasonal workers through street corner soapboxing. Many towns and cities worked to resist IWW organizing efforts by passing ordinances against such rallies. Wobblies challenged these repressive tactics. They would descend on a town or city in great numbers, forcing mass arrests that overwhelmed local authorities and judicial systems. At Spokane, the organizing campaign began a year earlier. Wobblies mobilized against local employment agencies that charged workers fees for jobs that didn't exist. The campaign was so popular that the IWW was able to establish a union hall, hold meetings and lectures, and establish a newspaper. The Spokane City Council quickly passed an ordinance against street corner rallies. When Wobblies learned that religious groups were exempt from the restrictive ordinance, they announced November 2nd as Free Speech Day in Spokane. They put out the call, wanted men to fill the jails of Spokane. By the end of the month, as many as 500 had been arrested. The War Department even offered up nearby Fort Wright to handle the glut of prisoners. A young Elizabeth Gurley Flynn arrived in Spokane to soapbox. Efforts to arrest her were briefly frustrated after she chained herself to a nearby lamppost. Flynn made good use of her time in jail. She reported on appalling prison conditions and accused the local sheriff of operating a brothel out of the women's prison section. The free speech fight gained nationwide attention and enjoyed wide public support. By March, all prisoners were released, the ordinance had been rescinded, and employment agencies' license revoked. The IWW won big.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a listener sent me a an image of a an invitation up in Buffalo. Evidently, Starbucks. Starbucks sent out an invitation to all of their how did it go? Their loyal, dedicated employees or whatever it was to go to this ritzy hotel in downtown Buffalo, so that they could have a night of of camaraderie or a partner event, I think is what they called it, with a special guest. And what they did is they pulled in the former CEO, Howard Schultz, to come in and basically browbeat them over the fact that the workers in Buffalo are scheduled to have a union vote, and they've asked the union, they've requested that the union ballots not go out for the election that begins this coming Wednesday. And I'm looking at this, I'm going, it seems to me, because we've seen a bunch of stories where they've sent out, executive vice presidents to come to the stores and sweep the floor and do all kinds of dumb stuff that they would never do before. Never. Like Howard Schultz flying to Buffalo in November to talk to, low-wage workers in a hotel room. That would never have happened unless they were scared. And it looks to me they're behaving, in my view, like they believe they're going to lose this, which is why they are pulling out all the stops and no expense being spared. And this, for me, is one of those moments. This is one of those moments when I think back to my grandfather, who said, if a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. if Howard Schultz and Starbucks is going to put money out to rent a ritzy hotel, have him fly in on his private jet, and then cater the thing and have, you know, all of that goings on and pay them for their time. You know, there's something in it for them. This is that moment where you go, hold on. They're spending, you know, probably tens of thousands of dollars. I'm not talking hundreds, but they're spending probably tens of thousands of dollars on this event to convince you that you don't need in a handful of locations that they could really easily close tomorrow and reopen across town and not blink because they're such a giant company. But they're so worried about that loss. And this looks like it could be that moment, where finally you start seeing some of these franchises and some of these giant corporations where workers have gone, you know what? Enough already. We deserve some bit of a voice. And this is one of those moments where I go, you know, look, I'm a big supporter of unions. I'm a big supporter of collective bargaining. I'm a big supporter of being compensated for the work that you do, unquestioningly. This is one of those moments where you go, this is democracy in the workplace. This is all those people in that place going, you know, we've made, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in profit for these companies, and we're still struggling to make ends meet. We're finally in this moment where people are going, instead of going, I'm just happy to have a job, going, I want that job to make my life better. This is it. And again, I don't know if this is the moment, but this is a moment. This is a moment where people are going, I've had enough, and willing to go to extremes. Now, the Starbucks there on Saturday night in Buffalo, all closed down so that they could bring these people together for a 5 to 7 shindig at the Hyatt Regency. Very nice. And you go, they brought in the head guy. Now stop and think about this for a second. Had they done this a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago? Had they treated these people like this when it mattered, instead of when they're looking at the vote happening? Maybe you don't get to this point. And I've said for the longest time, the vast majority of working people do not organize unions for wages. They don't. It used to be in the past, you know, my grandparents' generation, absolutely, because they needed better wages. It's usually about respect. It's usually about working conditions. It's usually about safety. And this is what they're getting here. The stories that you hear coming out of this is not, you know, the kind of things that the company would want you to believe. Because Howard Schultz, you know, said, how did he put it? It was, he built Starbucks around the idea that a for-profit company imbued with love, social conscience, and a shared success based on shared responsibility. That was his vision. He said, what the leadership team has done in Buffalo is what we have always done. Schultz wrote, we listen, we learn, we get better. No partner has ever needed to have a representative seek to obtain things we all have as partners at Starbucks. He says, I'm saddened and concerned to hear anyone thinks that is needed now. Here's the reality. It's always needed. It's always needed. It's not just magically, oh, now you need, it's always needed. You know, I look at someone like Schultz. I look at someone like the CEO class of this country. They all have contracts, every one of them. But yet you, the person who does the cleaning and the cooking and the pouring of the coffee and all that stuff, you don't get that same protection. You have to go begging hat in hand to him in what you're calling a partnership, but we know it's not an even partnership because it's still master and servant. They're still the boss. So your opinion, your thoughts, your rights, your views, your voice only go so far. Stops at the water's edge. Ultimately, like Trader Joe's, when the guy wrote the letter about, hey, you're not protecting us from COVID, and was summarily dismissed, fired as an at-will employee, that's the end of the road. So I'm hoping these folks go forward with their election on Wednesday. I hope they win overwhelmingly. And I hope Starbucks has made an example of it. I hope across the entire chain, people organize and demand better wages, hours, conditions, and respect. And then maybe I'll visit a Starbucks. I don't drink coffee, but you know, maybe I will. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
It's Thursday, November 4, 2021.
We can get real on coal, cars, cash, and trees.
Major agreements on methane, deforestation, and more at UN Climate Summit.
But getting commitments that translate to real change is no small lift.
As Critical World Conference moves into the negotiating phase. Plus, 2021 off-year elections deliver a mixed bag for the environment.
All of those mixed bags and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
More than 100 world leaders pledged to halt deforestation by 2030. Of course, to do that, they'll need a detailed plan that they'll need to print out on thousands upon thousands of pieces of paper.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a whole lot of stuff going on at COP26, the UN Climate Conference. But first, we've got some elections here in the U.S.
Yes, the environment was on the ballot in the off-year elections across the U.S. this week. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin, who says he's not sure if humans cause man-made climate change, edged out former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe for the governor's seat. In New Jersey, incumbent Democratic Governor Phil Murphy won a second term, which is good news for his massive initiative to remake the state into a regional hub for offshore wind energy.
Actually, it's good news for all of us on this planet.
Indeed. In Ohio, a Republican coal lobbyist won a special U.S. House election in a reliably red district. In New York State, voters approved an amendment to the state constitution guaranteeing New Yorkers the right to clean air and water and a healthy environment.
That should be interesting.
But in Maine, voters agreed with the ballot initiative to cancel a proposed high-voltage transmission line to deliver clean Canadian hydropower, which would have required clearing a miles-long path through the state's forest and was opposed by fossil fuel and utility interests. Hmm. High-voltage transmission lines are necessary for delivering renewable energy across long distances and are a growing area of contention and litigation. Meanwhile, in Glasgow, Scotland, the COP26 UN Climate Summit now moves into the grueling phase of negotiating the incredibly complex details and mechanisms to deliver on major deals announced by world leaders this week.
I'm sure it'll go really well, and it'll be totally easy.
Issues like wealthy countries financing adaptation and clean energy technology in developing countries, emissions trading, enforcement, transparency, and accountability. Before departing Glasgow, President Joe Biden urged world governments and the private sector to seize the moment.
This isn't just something we have to do to protect the environment and our future. It's an enormous opportunity for all of us, all of our nations, to create jobs and make meeting climate goals a core part of our global economic recovery as well.
More than 20 countries and financial institutions vowed to halt all financing for fossil fuel development overseas and divert an estimated $8 billion a year to clean energy projects instead.
Nice. Was the U.S. one of them?
Yes, we are. The U.K., European Union, and the U.S. all signed off on a new Just Energy Transition partnership with South Africa, promising more than $8 billion to help that country ditch their coal-fired power plants.
Good.
The European Union and the United States announced a deal to end their trade war over steel and aluminum launched by Donald Trump, but also will require the incredibly emissions-intensive steel industry to decarbonize, pushing international producers into clean production methods like green steel made using renewable energy.
Can that be done? You can generate enough heat with renewable energy?
They're doing it now in Sweden.
Nice. If they can do it there, we can do it here.
More than 100 countries signed on to a new pact to halt and reverse deforestation and land degradation by 2030. The Glasgow Leaders' Declaration on Forests and Land Use accounts for about 85% of the world's forests and includes billions in funding for sustainable forest management, conservation, and reforestation. More than 100 countries representing more than two-thirds of the global economy agreed to cut methane emissions by 30% by 2030, a very significant deal, yet it does not include major emitters like Russia and China. Because methane is a powerful climate-warming gas, reducing emissions now would have a rapid and significant effect on global warming. And finally, President Biden is backing up that methane pledge with action at home. The administration announced that the EPA and other federal agencies will now develop new methane leak standards to cut U.S. methane emissions by 70% below 2005 levels by 2030. And that will cover both new and existing infrastructure across the entire oil and gas industry supply chain. So lots of pledges and deals, but they all have to be backed up by action.
And they have to be not blocked here in the U.S. by the U.S. Supreme Court.
There's that, too.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
A little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight and a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart and maybe satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this is one of the dumber stories I've seen in a while. And look, here's the thing. I know Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. I've known him for years. I like him. I like the governor a lot. Voted for him twice. Like him an awful lot. Good man. Made good choices, good decisions as governor. This a bonehead. This not helpful. Governor, what the? Evidently, he was being interviewed on a station out west and said that his wife had dropped off his ballot ahead of him, ahead of Election Day. Here's the problem. Can't do that. Can take your own. Can't have someone drop off your ballot, even if it is your wife. But he said, I didn't show up at the polls, up in person at the polls. We voted a couple of weeks ago, actually, and went on to say, my wife actually dropped it off personally 2 weeks ago, so it's there. Now, potentially, you're in prison, $1,000 fine maximum. I hope Francis doesn't go to jail. But you know, the right wing gonna lose their ever-loving freaking minds over this. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
I'm looking at the governor, and like I said, I like Governor Wolf. I like him a lot. This was just dumb.
Now, see, in the state of Ohio, you can take the ballot and you can drop it into the ballot box for somebody in our state.
That is not the deal here, and I know some people allow that.
Noticed that.
But here's the thing. Well, if you're the governor, this is one of those things you go, you're the governor, man.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question, because I didn't know this was the way it is in Pennsylvania. But, you know, if you're, if somebody fills out an absentee and you want to take it to the post office for them, or you want to drop it into the box, you can do that. Obviously, your state has something different. Has anybody in the past been prosecuted for doing this?
Not yet, no. Not that I know.
If somebody else has been prosecuted, he might have to, I don't know, if it's a misdemeanor, do, you know, a couple days somewhere, you know.
Yeah,
still carry out executive duties, but he might have to do it from a smaller room.
A remote location.
Smaller room, you know.
But I'm going, you know, this is not the time to be doing this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I wouldn't, when I read the story, I thought, okay, so wait a minute, you know. Somebody fills it out, they seal it, and they hand it to you, and you put it in the box, so what? I just didn't know that your state did that.
Yeah, the only time I was able to vote absentee prior to the pandemic was, you know, probably about 10 years ago, where I knew I was going to be out of town. It was one of those things where I went down, I said, hey, I'm going to be out of town. I filled it out right there, and I turned it in right there. It was one of those things, I didn't even leave with it. And, you know.
See, if they don't mail it in, if somebody, the way I was reading the story, your law in Pennsylvania says you can fill it out. Carol can go ahead and mail it for you if you're going to mail it. She can physically take it from you and mail it, but she can't physically put it in the box, which is kind of weird.
There's a lot of weird here.
I mean, that is weird. Why? You can mail it for somebody else, take it from them physically, drive 20 miles to another post office and mail, but you can't take it from them and, you know, go down the street and put it in the drop-in box.
Right.
Strange.
Yeah, that's how screwy our laws are. But again, we've got 67 different counties and 67
right.
different ways of doing things.
Right.
And I'm told this is part of our strength.
Well,
I'm not getting
so we'll
a response.
We'll see what happens to him. If nobody else has been prosecuted, they probably won't prosecute him. Of course, that won't change the story.
Not going to change the story. This is going to be, you know, now, you know, I'm already getting the emails from people how the governor, you know, voted illegally and voter fraud and the whole thing needs to be overturned. And
but, you know, these happen to both parties. I mean, you know, the governor, Newsom in California went to an indoor-outdoor wine party or whatever it was, and, you know, Hades broke loose.
Yeah, well, Youngkin's kid tried to vote twice at 17.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, this is what happens.
Yeah, so maybe the two of them will share a
song. You're in the spotlight.
Yeah, which is why my wife will never let me run for anything. as she gives me
that would be a fun campaign to manage your campaign.
No, I would love to. It's one of those things that
it would be fun. It would be unleashed.
if I ever do, you're the first call.
The title of the campaign.
If I ever do, you're the first call.
It would be. I would definitely donate time for that one. That would be fun.
Outstanding. Let's move along. The infrastructure bill. This is a big deal.
It is. It's a good bill. It is. It lacked 6 Democrat votes and it picked up 13 Republican when it comes down to the votes, which is what they run the stories on. But the most important part is $110 billion for the roads and bridges. And you go down the list, you know, you've got rail services, broadband, water infrastructure, flooding, airports. And I was on 2 of these pieces of legislation in the past. The last one, I think, was 2006, if I remember right. And what I don't understand about this is the retaliation against the 13 Republicans by the Republicans. If you could ever, you know, get away with a bill these days, this is it.
Yep.
This is mom and apple pie. This is going to help improve, you know, development for areas, also, you know, improve lives. So this is one that I think that the ones that voted for it can say to the colleagues who are Republican, you know, get a life. And plus it was, to an extent, bipartisan in the Senate, which never occurs.
Yeah, 19 senators. But, you know,
right.
when you've got Marjorie Taylor Greene saying infrastructure is communism, you know you've jumped the shark.
Right. Now, the reason they're mad, too, is because they gave Speaker Pelosi, quote, a win in the House, you know, and then President Biden. But, again, it was a win for everybody. I will tell you that Andy Card, who was chief of staff of President Bush, was furious about not taking away, you know, prevailing wage
right.
in the bill. And he and I know I had a personal horrific conversation with him. It was, you know, didn't go well between the two of us over that issue. And it's interesting why he did that. You have to you look at the histories of some of these things. When he was with Bush 41, and Bush 41 passed an infrastructure bill, and he lost the election, Andy Card blamed that bill for Bush 41's election loss. Think about that. That was not why he lost the election.
Now, the Republicans did try to gut it out of the bipartisan bill. Mm-hmm. In fact, John Cornyn right. from Texas sure. Tried yeah, to amend it out, and it got voted right in. So,
right.
You know, this is where I gave them credit. Look, you need this. This is what's going to make those, 10 million jobs or whatever they're saying right. are potentially going to be out there, 20 million, an estimated 20 million new jobs. Those are going to make those jobs good jobs. The fact that they're going to be prevailing wage jobs and people can actually make a living off of them.
Right. It's a good bill, and it, you know, there'll be a lot of credit for this bill out there because it does do something that's long overdue. And, you know, again, it's neither here nor there now. This should have been separated out a long while back and passed because everybody is still in the same boat when it comes to the other human infrastructure bill that they would have been in 4 months ago. Same boat.
Right.
You know, it's going to sink or swim based on a couple members of the Senate.
So where do you think it goes here? I mean, you know, because you got the six Democrats who voted against it. There were the squad plus
right.
Jamal Brown, I believe, or
right.
Bowman, Jamal Bowman.
Right.
So you had the squad plus one guy who voted against it, and that was ceremonial. That was to say, hey, look, we're ticked that the other bill didn't come along,
right.
and that was, you know, that was okay because they had the votes to do it. Does the other thing ever get done? Does this die here?
Well, it won't have a bearing. The six voting against it won't have any type of bearing in the House at all. And frankly, it won't have any type of bearing of like, okay, we're going to get you because you did this in the Senate at all.
Right.
This is if they would have all voted for the $1.2 trillion, all six, it again wouldn't make a difference as to what is in the minds of Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema. It still is going to boil down to those two. So it's irrelevant what had happened.
Right, but the six of them voted against it simply so they could go back to their supporters and go, we voted against
sure.
it because it didn't walk hand in hand with the other bill.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
that's how this is played out.
Right.
It wasn't that they were traitors, that they hate infrastructure. It's that they were,
right.
you know, this was their protest about the other thing not coming. And it still
right.
was going to pass. It's not like those six votes ended up tanking the bill.
Right, and they are doing this as a matter of, again, saying to, you know, the people that follow them and their base that, you know, we tried to link these two together, and they did. They tried originally, and then there was going to be a vote, as we remembered, in September 27th, and there's going to be another vote at another time. Again, I think that the two could have been decoupled in the first place a long time ago, 3 or 4 months ago. They could have been, and probably should have been, decoupled anyway. But the six that are, you know, kind of leading the progressive cause in the House felt that, at the time, coupling these two together gave them a better chance to get everything. But it really didn't matter anyway because, again, Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, it wouldn't have mattered to them what those six did.
Yeah.
So, yes, they, you know, stood for the matter of principle, and they're not against the infrastructure.
Well, we'll see where it goes. On Sunday, it's Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner.
Yeah.
COVID's over, I guess, right? We're closing to the
right.
end of it? Is this what I believe?
There's several stories this week that were definitely troublesome, I think. And there's a little bit of argument in the National Institute of Health, and some of that contradicts what Dr. Fauci has said and by some of his own colleagues over in the National Institute of Health. That was one troubling story, and I know science is debatable, and you know, that's where this comes from, but when Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, was on television Sunday on one of the major Sunday shows, and he came out and it's been carried that yes, you know, basically this thing's kind of really done, and he makes a point of why it's done, and for several points, but one of the things he said is that, you know, he thinks we're close to the end of this. The Delta wave is the last major wave of infection. We don't know how this morphs yet. It could morph into, you know, the Delta and the Alpha and the everything else under the sun. And then also, he said that having the pill available to treat coronavirus at home, you know, is basically going to have an effect. Then he made another statement. This one is really something when you look at it. He said, first is the fact that the COVID-19 vaccine is now available to children as young as 5. Well, that's okay when he says that that will be a major factor to decrease this if, in fact, people actually get inoculations.
Right.
Right. If they do, right now, only 57%, if my memory serves me correct, as of today, have had the 2 shots. In this country, 57%. I know it's under 60. Now, in a great world, if 80% of everybody gets the 2 shots, guess what? I'll go on the Sunday shows and say it's going to decrease this winter. So he's basing it on things that could happen.
Yeah.
And it just gave a false narrative, I think, out there that, you know, the headline, we're close to the end. Oh, okay. Just take your masks, throw them away, and don't go bother getting a shot because we're close to the end anyway.
Yeah, it's over. Scary stuff. And finally, evidently the 2022 midterm elections have already begun. Evidently the National Republican Congressional Committee, they're going to start running some ads soon, right?
Yes, I think this one's a waste of money at this point in time, to be frank. They're going to run this one-day nationwide campaign. And, of course, this is the year out, and although in January will start, you know, the new election year, obviously, and they're going to run the ad Monday, today, on Fox News, Newsmax, and One American News Network. So there's 2 things here, Rick. Number one, they're preaching to the choir if they're running it on Fox, all right, and One American News Network, so they're preaching to the choir on that one. And the second thing, it's going to run for one day. And the other, they're spending under $100,000 for the ad. So this is more of an inside pep rally. Now, the bottom line will be that, you know, quote, Americans deserve better than the higher costs, which is inflation, open borders, and nationwide crime wave that the Democrats have forced on them. They're forcing nationwide crime.
So what they're doing is they're putting this out for OAN and Fox and the rest of them to then run with this as a story. Instead of a paid ad.
Correct. That's right. They ran it. It's for a story.
Got it.
They got a $100,000 story. So the actual impact of it is, you know, is low. But they're setting the tone and the game plan of what they're going to run on. So
there you go. Well,
the other side knows it now. So Democrat side needs just to, not that they didn't know it yesterday.
Okay. There you go. Bob, I appreciate the time,
Thank you,
man.
Rick.
Thanks so much, always. Our good friend Bob Nay. Let's take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1897. That was the day that Dorothy Day, a leader of the Catholic worker movement, was born in Brooklyn, New York. As a young girl, her family moved to San Francisco. Her father lost his job as a sports writer due to the devastating earthquake of 1906, and the family relocated again to Chicago. In 1932, she met Peter Morin, and together they founded the Catholic Worker Movement, a faith-based social justice effort. The Catholic workers opened what they called houses of hospitality to serve those in need. Dorothy helped to co-found The Catholic Worker, a monthly newspaper that became a voice for poor and working people. While writing for the paper, Dorothy traveled and visited with some of the most exploited workers in the country. She talked with migrant agricultural workers in California and was arrested for supporting the United Farm Workers in 1973. In 1940, she visited the Hooverville encampment in Seattle, Washington. Dorothy's reporting vividly demonstrated how her faith informed her activism. She wrote, quote, "The rain poured down, underneath was mud, ankle deep, and the long lane that cut between the rows of shacks reflected the gray clouds in its pools. But Christ is there. I thought sadly, there in the mud, in the shacks with his poor, with them he is trying to find a place to lay his head. With them he hungers, and with them he suffers fatigue of body and soul. Behold, O God, our Redeemer, and look upon the face of thy Christ. There in the dumps, among the creatures who still are men, have pity on them and on us who permit such things to be." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A couple of responses real quick to my my statement that Democrats need to get out on the picket line and actually do something. Meet a working person. Adopt a working person. That's what we should be doing right now, having an Adopt a Striker campaign. We should run that hashtag, Adopt a Striker. And you know, James points out, stop ghosting us Dems, deliver on your message and follow through. Walk the walk, walk the picket line, hashtag kitchen table issues. And yeah, you know, that's the reality. We need people who are going to know what that's like. Seth says, can say from my own experience that being part of a picket line is life-changing in one's work environment. It will always be before and after, gain of comrades, loss of others, all along knowing management is willing to bet their odds. Pawns have the most to lose. And look, you know, the sad reality is this is what management is hoping for. In fact, the John Deere strike right now, they're trying to figure out how long those people can stay out, you know, and how long they can go without a paycheck, and how they can manipulate just a small number of people. Because look, they voted, you know, 55 to 45. All you need to do is flip 6%, and now it's now an agreement instead of being voted down. And that's what they're working diligently to do, which is why you're seeing some of these stories in the Des Moines newspaper about how one guy, he's afraid, won't say his name, but he wants to go back because, you know, it was okay. You know, I care about my coworkers. Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of manipulation that you see. This is the kind of insanity that has been allowed to happen in our country for way too long, which is why we need major comprehensive labor law reform, and we need it now. Simple. I mean, I look at John Deere, man, one of the most profitable companies in this country. And what you get is that. Good on them for standing up. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You want to follow us on social media, @ricksmith on Twitter, @ricksmithshow on Twitter. Follow us on Facebook. You can like us there, share some stuff. Also, YouTube, subscribe, give us a comment, and maybe a share as well. All good stuff. Thanks so much for tuning in. Got lots to get to this week. Not going to want to miss it. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at therickSmithShow.com.